Hi, I'm Scott Miller, host of Career on Course, where our vision is in the coming months and years to interview hundreds, if not thousands, of career experts to bring to you all the details you need to make better career decisions for you. We will have piercingly insightful conversations with an occupational therapist, a software developer, a wind turbine technician, pastry chef, event planner, chief financial officer, a barber, you name it. If the career exists, I'm going to interview them and bring to you what's the day in the life look like? What are the ups and the downs? What are the interpersonal conflicts? How do you pivot out? How do you stay in? When people burn out, why do they leave? Every question you might have, I'm intending to ask a wide variety of career professionals so that this podcast can help you pick better. Let's get started with getting your career on course. Welcome back to another episode of Career on Course. I'm your host, Scott Miller, where in every episode, we highlight and feature career professionals that have deep expertise on what it's like to actually have that job. What are the ups and the downs and the good and the bad and the underbelly? How do you pivot in? How do you pivot out? Why do people quit? Why do people thrive? Today, our guest is Jessica Kahn. She's the founder of Blue Sky Therapeutics. And as she calls it, she's an occupational therapist. Now, I'll tell you, when I first met Jessica nearly 14 years ago, I wasn't sure what an occupational therapist was. I thought maybe it was someone that was a therapist for people's occupations, like a career coach. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Jessica Kahn, welcome to Career on Course.
Thank you.
What is an occupational therapist?
And I get that question all the time. It's a confusing title. So occupational therapy is a branch of healthcare. And we treat people of all ages with various physical limitations, cognitive limitations, behavioral limitations, emotional limitations in all aspects of their life. So we define occupation as anything that you do during the day. Getting up in the morning and getting out of bed, that's an occupation. Going to school and having to learn, that's an occupation. Getting dressed, brushing your teeth, eating meals, those are all defined as occupations. So we enhance people's ability to be as independent as possible throughout the day.
So Jessica, I know as a healthcare provider, you obviously have to respect HIPAA laws and privacy issues. So we'll make sure that we're respectful of your confidentiality with patients. Generally speaking, are occupational therapists working with people of all ages and abilities? Do people specialize in adolescents or infants or elder care? Tell us about the kind of segments that are within an occupational therapy career.
Sure. So occupational therapy and occupational therapists span the entire lifetime. So when you graduate from OT school, most often you will specialize in a demographic. You'll specialize in an age group. Personally, I'm a pediatric OT. But if you want to work with babies that are or newborns, that's neonatal. All the way through, you take people to really the end of their lifespan. That would be geriatric care or end-of-life care.
Jessica, walk us through your college education. Were there some specific decisions you were faced with that drove you into this particular career? What was your undergraduate degree? What was your graduate degree? Kind of walk us through your decision-making process to enter this career. Gosh, I'm guessing 20 plus years ago.
Yeah, thank you for that. It was a long time ago. I would say that I always knew that I wanted to go into the medical field. In terms of what part of the medical field, that took some time to discover. And I was introduced to occupational therapy when my grandmother went to her physical therapist. And I didn't really know anything about it. And I met an OT at that clinic. And I was able to see just a different side of rehab that I really didn't know existed. And so from that point on, when I was an undergrad, and my undergrad degree was in psychology, and often that's pretty common. It's either the sciences or psychology. And you do have to take all the prereqs for med school. It's really similar as going into med school. But I personally knew that I didn't want to go to med school. So I just got really interested in the field due to its creativity and the availability of all the things that it does and all the areas that it covers. So undergrad was in psychology, and then you have to take all your pre-med requisites. and then apply to graduate school. So I have a master's degree. Nowadays, a lot of the programs, and I know we'll talk about this, are switching over to doctorates. So that was my path in discovering I want to be in the medical field, but what area fits me? What area suits me? There are lots of options when you go down that road.
To be a licensed occupational therapist, you can't do that with just an undergraduate degree. Right now, it requires a graduate degree, and you're saying it's moving more towards a, is it a PhD, or what would the doctorate level be?
It's a doctorate. It's a doctorate of OT. So lots of programs used to be either bachelor's, which was undergraduate. They have gotten rid of all of those programs, and then it turned to master's, which is what I have. And I think that a lot of colleges and institutions are phasing out the master's program and really encouraging people to get what's called a DOT, a doctorate of occupational therapy.
Jessica, you have an interesting role because you're a practitioner, but you also teach and advise and coach other budding occupational therapists. I don't expect you to have answers to all my questions, but academically, have you found that the degrees are fairly ubiquitous? A lot of universities offer these. Is there a fairly few number of them? How difficult is it to get accepted to an OT graduate program?
I would say that it's not easy. It is difficult, and it has become more difficult as they've moved away from master's degrees and moved towards doctorate degrees. And I can't speak as to what the different requirements are. Obviously, it's still all those pre-med courses. You have to have a certain number of volunteer hours. I started those in high school, and I did that all the way through college. So you have to have a certain number of hours. And then for the doctorate, there's a certain level of research that comes along with that too. That's what getting a doctorate means. You have to either teach, be a part of some sort of a program that allows you to be a professor, an adjunct professor, and then you also have to do research as part of that program.
Jessica, I'm guessing in your 2+ decades in this field, you've networked with a lot of like-minded colleagues. I'm sure there are associations and groups. Have you found that there's like a common set of personality traits or skills or passions or curiosities that OTs tend to share? Or is it just a very broad group that magnetizes people from all different walks of life and different interests?
So I would say the biggest thing is patience. Okay. So you are definitely hands-on with families, with children, with adults who are in some way working on getting back to whatever meaningful life roles and choices that they have. And that's very difficult for anybody. It's also difficult for families. And so the education and the therapy doesn't just stop with whatever client you have. It also extends to their families. So patience is a huge part of this job, of this career. The other piece to that is being able to navigate different ways to provide interventions. So if I have something in my mind that I'm going to work with a child, and that child comes to therapy and they're not in the place that I need them to be, I have to be able to change quickly on the fly to meet them where they are. And that spans that's a lifespan thing. That's adults. It's everybody. So you really have to be able to be flexible. You have to have really good patience. And then you also have to be open to learning. I've been an OT for 20 some years. Every year I do continuing education. And I work with undergraduate and graduate students on new ideas, on new research. Things are always coming out. And you have to be willing to accept that you don't know everything. And as you journey through this field, keeping up on today's research. So I would say that those are the three main things that I would say entering this field are super important.
Jessica, you mentioned patience and flexibility. Are you naturally a patient person? Did you have to develop that discipline? Were you to take classes on that? I mean, how, I don't know that side of you enough to know. Are you naturally a patient person?
It's interesting. I am naturally patient with my clients. I would say that in my personal life, it's an area of need. It's an area of struggle. But it really hasn't been with my kiddos that I work with. And even with my students, I love teaching. And I love when I get fieldwork students because nothing is greater than passing on all these different ideas and passing on this career. So I entered the career, I would say, with a level of patience for my career and for my clients. when I shut the door and go home at night, am I great at that? Probably not. I could be better.
But you just described everybody. So I can appreciate that and I validate you. And I can tell you're a great teacher. I can tell that's a passion of yours. Do you find that occupational therapists also tend to be teaching and mentoring? Do some just stay within their client base? Is it a natural migration to also be teaching and coaching as well? Or is there a natural answer to that?
I would say that some people are not natural teachers and have no desire to work with students. That is something that I love, my time with my students. I welcome that because also I learn from them. So they're, again, like I said, they're going through the different programs and they're learning newer techniques, newer different types of interventions. So it's always a two-way street. And I always tell them that I may be your fieldwork supervisor, but I am learning from you as well. And you have to be open to that. And I love that dynamic in that relationship. It's not for everybody. And it's interesting. I will take one-on-one students when I have to lecture in a classroom, which I do. I like it, but I like it less. I'd rather have that one-on-one teaching dynamic.
You addressed this a little bit earlier, but hark back to your undergraduate, maybe graduate school days. Were there any particular courses or classes that were necessary to graduate, but you really struggled with because it was not your natural inclination? I guess I want people to understand these are the types of classes you're going to have to pass an ACE in order to be graduated and licensed. Talk about your own personal experience there.
Yes, and I love this question. Something that people don't realize when they go into OT school is the mental health aspect of the field. You can help someone increase their range of motion. You can help someone start walking again. I can help a child learn how to do handwriting. But there is a mental health aspect of this profession that I think surprise people. So through graduate school, there's a whole mental health semester, if not two mental health semesters. And one of the classes was really a challenge for everybody was group dynamics. What role do you play in a team setting? How do you communicate? What strengths and weaknesses do you have and interpersonal skills when you're interacting with other people? I think it spans all of healthcare, but I think it surprises people. That is a huge aspect of the field. And it's an ongoing process. I'll tell you real quickly, one of my field works was in mental health in an outpatient facility. And these patients were fairly severe. It was the hardest 3 months of my life. It was the hardest 3 months of my career because you are dealing in an area of psychology. It's a challenge and you have to use your own psyche to interact, develop interactions and communicate.
Jessica, I came to know you, gosh, over a decade ago. We actually hired you to help one of our three sons, but our son hadn't had an accident. There wasn't a serious health problem. There are occasions, circumstances when you're helping adolescents that aren't recovering from an injury or have perhaps, you know, a health issue from birth. You're also dealing with otherwise very healthy, you might say mainstream patients that are working on improving the issue. Talk about that to the extent you're comfortable.
So patients that come for OT, every setting is a little bit different. You don't have to have a diagnosis. And we can talk about insurance companies, which is one of the greatest barriers to the profession. But you don't have to have a diagnosis. You don't have to have a diagnosis to come see me in private practice for OT. If you have a kiddo that has handwriting that's not awesome, if you have a kiddo that has a hard time sitting still, these aren't things that necessarily require a diagnosis, but there are always areas to improve. In terms of adults are more, you do seek that piece of, not an accident, but some sort of a trauma that has elicited a need for rehab. Whereas for younger kiddos, that doesn't necessarily happen. However, there are always areas to improve. There are always areas to catch up on. And so for me personally, I don't need a kiddo to have a diagnosis code to improve upon their function.
Jessica, let's talk about physicality, like the location of practices. I'm guessing you and other OTs have practices in the education setting with maybe perhaps hospitals or rehab, maybe community health centers. Talk about the different physical locations that OTs practice and can place themselves.
Okay. And you touched on a lot of them. So the obvious one is hospitals, right? Anything from the NICU to acute care to traumatic brain injury rehab facilities to those offsite facilities where people are not in the hospital, but they're rehabbing various types of conditions. There are outpatient facilities for all ages. I would say home health health is a big one that people don't realize. OTs can come to your house and go into your house. That's the best setting because that's really where you are naturally functioning. Old age homes, I hate that term, but in those types of facilities, there are always OTs. And then inpatient. So like in a children's hospital, they will have a rehab gym where patients will come from being at home. They're not in the hospital. So all kinds of different gyms and inpatient and outpatient facilities. Also in jails, people don't realize that either. That mental health aspect that we talked about, there are lots of programs for rehabilitation for criminals. And then in all kinds of mental health facilities as well.
Jessica, as you may know, I recently lost a parent and my dad went through some physical therapy. I'm guessing occupational therapy. My mother is moving into an adult living center. You might refer to it as old folks home. We call it adult living centers. I'm kidding.
I'm interested to know,
what's the difference between a physical therapist and an occupational therapist?
Okay. And it's interesting. There's a joke in my profession that says that physical therapy is the waist down and occupational therapy is the waist up, including everything that happens up here cognitively. I really look at physical therapy as a lot of body mechanics in terms of moving your body. And we cross over in that way because occupational therapists are certified hand therapists. And that is also mechanical. When you have any issue to your upper extremities, you want to go see an occupational therapist. And most people don't know that. They go right to a physical therapist. But you certified hand therapists are typically occupational therapists. In terms of brain injuries, cognition, social, emotional, any of those barriers to completing your daily occupations, that's occupational therapy. Getting back to those daily functions. Yes, you need a physical therapist there to help as well in terms of walking and navigating your environment. But I would say that occupational therapy allows more for those daily functions. And one of the reasons I went into the career is because you can be so creative with those types of interventions. And it's fun. And I mentioned when my grandmother was in PT, she was walking up and down steps. She was standing up and down from the bed. But with an OT, you get to be creative. You get to do art. You get to do cooking. You get to go to different places and spaces to get these people back to their daily living, to what that means for them.
Jessica, I've watched your career from afar, but I've noticed that you've been in private practice where you actually had an office with some therapist who worked with and for you. I've known that you've assigned to certain schools, private schools, public schools, charter schools. I've seen you in the university setting. So you actually may be an outlier in terms of the agility with which you've managed your practice. What's the day in the life of an occupational therapist? If you had to pick a fairly typical day, you get up, you get your family off to their lives, and then what happens? Walk us through what a typical day looks like.
I would say that I'm not the norm, so I'm not going to comment on myself first because I do have a private practice. I'm a one-woman show. I can create my own schedule. But if we're looking at the field as a whole, the day is quite busy. The day is quite fast. When you are an OT in a hospital, you are patient to patient to patient, getting productivity met and getting quota met and making sure that you are seeing your entire caseload. And in acute care, that's fairly intense. I would also say that goes for outpatient care. So if you're in an outpatient pediatric clinic or an outpatient rehab clinic, you're back to back. Clients, patients, all day long. So when I go into a school, same thing. I would say that if you're the OT to school, you've got a caseload of students. And when you do go into schools, unfortunately, OTs are spread fairly thin in that regard. So you may have four elementary schools assigned to one person. So every day you're at a different school and you're seeing perhaps 20 kids. And so for me, I've been able to pick and choose my schedule and whatnot in private practice. One of the reasons I went into private practice. So I have a certain number of kids that I like to see per day. I have a morning or two that I devote to some schools, and that's what my schedule looks like.
Sounds like there are, to your point earlier, a lot of similarities with a nurse practitioner or a physician in terms of how your time is managed and your productivity. Is that one of the reasons why you Yes. chose private practice so that you could be more in control of your time?
100%. And to be my own boss, if I'm being honest. So yes, because when you do start working for institutions, when you work for schools, you do have that fairly significant caseload that you have to fit in. And on top of that, something we haven't touched on, documentation is a fairly significant part of this career. You got to fit all that in too. And most places don't necessarily reimburse you for documentation. So even when I have a certain number of kids each day, I have to log on and I have to document that for insurance companies and for families.
We'll talk about compensation if you're willing in just a few moments here.
Of course.
Here's a question for you. What's one thing that was totally surprising for you about the job? No one prepared you for this, not your mentors, your coaches, your professors, your part-time volunteer work, whatever it was to build your hours. When you got into the role, you said, oh my gosh, no one told me this. Maybe one positive thing and one critical negative thing.
I'll start with the positive. The positive thing is the relationships that you build with families, not just the client. So no matter what client you're working with, you're also working with that family, right? Either a client or patient's being discharged to their home, into their care. For me, the kids obviously are at home with their parents. So wonderful relationships being formed with not just the client is an amazing part of my job. The things that no one prepares you for, which you just said we'll touch on, is the reimbursement and the dealing with insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And that hits me hard because I'm in private practice, but it spans the settings of OT. And even in my graduate program, they'll tell you that documentation, that plays such a huge part. But that has been a road that has been challenging, and you have to learn how to play that game. So insurance companies is what no one prepares you for.
I'm guessing to that point, like any healthcare provider, whether you're an anesthesiologist or a psychiatrist or a physician, you probably prefer self-pay clients because you're not getting paid for the time it takes for all the documentation and the reimbursement. Is that a true statement? I'm guessing you'll treat any client that comes to you if they meet your expertise. I'm guessing you prefer self-pay clients.
So you're not wrong. I do. And what happened is when I opened up my practice, I put myself on every insurance panel and I quickly learned which ones were worth my time in terms of all the hoops that I would have to jump through to deal with them. So currently I'm still on a couple different insurance companies because I don't want to limit accessibility to certain families, but the ones that are out of pocket are much easier to deal with in terms of reimbursement, in terms of documentation and time, quite honestly.
Jessica, I really appreciate how pragmatic this conversation is and how vulnerable you are. As I listen to you, I start to realize you remind me a lot of all of the healthcare providers that I know, because you have to have a level of discretion and confidentiality, just like a psychiatrist, just like any kind of doctor. I'm guessing you treat patients of families and friends that you socialize with in your community. Talk to how important it is that occupational therapists practice, I'm guessing both legally and ethically, a level of confidentiality that sometimes you're tempted to talk about someone's son or daughter that you know and you realize, oh my gosh, I can't talk about that.
It's part of the job that I'm so used to. I'm actually never tempted to talk about any client that I treat. Our people try to talk to me about it, but there's never a temptation there. And I very quickly shut that down. It's illegal. Bottom line, it's illegal. I have HIPAA obligations, rules and regulations that I have to follow. It would be 100% illegal and inappropriate and unprofessional for me to discuss any aspect of my patient care with anyone. And as I live in a smaller town, yes, I get questions about this or that. I never answer them. It's just, I can't discuss that. And that goes across any setting in OT.
Let's pivot to what goes wrong. When you think of an occupational therapist and they burnt out, they pivoted out, they just left. Was there a circumstance that maybe is relatable, not a nuanced one, but one that's ubiquitous to say, here's why people leave the field?
I would say the demand of client productivity in various settings is why people burn out. So when I think of some people that I went to graduate school with, it has a lot to do with that, right? We were working in a school district. We were spread out against 7 schools. I had to see 20 kids in each school. There's only so long that's mentally sustainable to do that. Same thing in hospital settings. Unfortunately, bringing in reimbursement is more important to certain institutions as opposed to often the well-being of a healthcare provider or even quality care. It's quality versus quantity. So I think that's turned a lot of people off. what's sad to me is I do see some younger OTs, newer grads, that are already reaching that point because there is such a need to fill a quota. There's such a need to see 8 kids a day, to do 10 evals per week. And it's a lot. And so that would be the driving force. The second thing underneath that, reimbursement. Insurance sometimes can make it really difficult to make things worth your while, especially when the documentation needs are fairly high. So I would say that those three things combined, could drive people out.
Let's go deeper into that. You've talked a lot about the frustrations, the necessity. You understand it. You're a pragmatic person to have insurance. Not everyone can self-pay, right? To have themselves or their children have your therapy. Can you give us some sense for the economics of the role? What generally are some starting salaries? You teach and coach a lot of college students coming out, so you're probably pretty familiar with starting salaries. What's the upward level? And maybe for more entrepreneurial therapists like yourself, what are other ways to augment their income? Take that anywhere you'd like to go. The more practical and give us some numbers would be helpful.
Okay. So I'm first going to say it depends on your setting. Okay. So if you go into an outpatient facility, you're going to make more money. If you work for a hospital, you're going to make less money. Typically, I'm going to say that a starting salary can be anywhere from 50 to 70, but haven't researched that recently. So that's just a ballpark figure.
Yeah.
I would say you can enter 3 figures in private practice and working for more smaller facilities where insurance doesn't play such a role on things, where Medicare isn't dictating what you can and can't do. So I want to say it starts around 50, and a lot of places now have moved to hourly rates. And the problem with that is that if you don't see a patient, for example, if you're in a pediatric setting and that client doesn't show up, you don't get paid. You're there, but you might not get paid because that client didn't show up. That's a challenge. I'll tell you about a friend of mine in graduate school. A lot of people do seek other avenues. So going into administration, running rehab clinics, taking on other administrative roles in various clinics and hospitals is a way to increase that revenue. I would say that adding on to your degree, the more letters you have at the end of your name, perhaps that will increase your earning potential. Teaching, that's a separate area that you can go into that will increase or add on to whatever your salary may be. Home health tends to pay well. They're reimbursing you for driving and gas and going into people's homes. That's always been an area where I've seen salaries that are on the higher end of things. And then I have some friends who I went to graduate school who have left actual patient care and gone on to develop tools and equipment. So OT deal, we have a lot of equipment in a pediatric facility. You have swings, you have tires, you have all kinds of fun things. And then for adults, there are different types of equipment to help people get dressed, to help people cook. So there's that whole area. You can get different catalogs with all this equipment that people can transition into.
Jessica, when you left your graduate degree, did you immediately open up your private practice or did you work in a more traditional setting somewhere and then you became what I would call an entrepreneur?
Yes, I did. I left graduate school and worked in, there were 3 different settings that I went through, pediatric settings. I was at a therapeutic day school. I worked in for a school district and outpatient pediatric before I settled to where we live now and decided there was a need for it. And I started very slowly. I started seeing children actually in a school in an early childhood center that was in the town that I live in. And it expanded and built from there. The other piece to that is before opening up that private practice, there are tons of continuing education credits that one would want to seek to almost have the credibility to open up their own private practice. I spent a month in North Carolina getting what is called a sensory integration certification, tons of certifications in my field. So when you do specialize, it's really important to do that. So you have that extra training that you don't get in graduate school to proceed with kind of that entrepreneurial piece.
I'm guessing if someone was thinking of being an occupational therapist and they wanted to have their own practice, they probably would follow a fairly similar route that you did. A couple of years of reps in a couple of different settings and then decide they wanted to go into business. Do you bill your time as a private practice therapist. Is your time billed similar to what I might think of as a psychiatrist or psychologist? Is it like an hour-long session? How does that work usually?
Yes, correct. So my sessions are 50 minutes long. In my specific setting, evaluations may tend to be a little bit longer. It's completely the same, but that's my setting. So in a hospital, if you're in acute care, those sessions may be 20 minutes long. And you may see the same client two or three times a week. Typically for me, I see a kiddo once a week for a 50-minute session.
Let's talk about the underbelly of this job. You appropriately referenced the challenge that is all the paperwork, not being paid for documentation, and trying to have your fee schedule met by different insurance plans. I think people can assimilate to that and the frustration that exists throughout healthcare. Is there some other downside to the job that you'd like people to really know, hey, prepare for this because this is fatiguing. This is a surprise. Maybe it's personal hygiene. Maybe it's people that are abusive to you. I'm guessing there's a lot of things. I love it for you to get really transparent and say, hey, prepare for these three or four things because you're going to experience them.
So the answer is yes. There are all of those things. My kids smell pretty good, but I have been thrown up on. So that's a thing. Those types of things do happen. There's a whole toileting aspect of occupational therapy that we can't ignore at all spans of life. But what I will tell you is you do get, in my setting, but it expands everywhere. You do get families or clients that don't necessarily buy into what you're doing. So for you to be successful and work with these clients, you also need them to do their part and their work when you're not there, or you need a family to help carry out certain at-home interventions, it doesn't always happen. Or you're having to explain over and over again why you're doing what you're doing with someone who isn't available to hear that or to understand what it is or why you're doing it. And yes, I have dealt with a lot of families and dynamics where I don't know that people are abusive per se, but they're just not buying in to the different aspects of what needs to happen when you're not around, when clients are at home or at school. I would say that it's hard to get a buy-in from teachers in pediatrics. You want them to do certain things in a classroom. They've got a classroom full of kids. They look at you like you're crazy. So yes, and then overall, how we started this conversation, explaining what occupational therapy is, it's not tangible. And so I think it's hard sometimes for people to buy into some of these interventions and carry them out. And then there's the part, the separate part of, hey, you owe this bill, you owe this money. And then they like to be combative about that. That's a whole nother part of it.
I'm guessing part of your job is persuasive sales. It's communicating effectively to the parents, the grandparents, the caregivers, the nanny, whoever it is, to help them understand what your process is, why you're doing it. You're probably explaining the process as much to the caregiver, if you will, as you are to the perhaps patient.
Yes, 100%. And the problem with that sometimes is that sometimes there's a language barrier, to be very honest, in my with different childcare. I would say that sometimes parents aren't always available, right? There's a babysitter or whatnot who brings their child to therapy, and that's your means of communication, but that doesn't necessarily carry over to parents at home. So yes, it is a lot of explaining over and over again, not only what's going on and how that affects function, but how can we help this child other than going to OT once a week? Or how can we help this patient other than coming into rehab once a week? We need to be doing things at home and taking responsibility for that.
Let's talk about adjacencies. Every profession has some off-ramps, right? Barbers can become cosmetologists. Barbers can own barber salons and develop products. If you think about it, every career has some adjacencies. Talk to the extent you've experienced any of these firsthand or through your friends and network. When someone becomes a occupational therapist, you mentioned there's all kinds of certificates and advanced training that can help you obviously with your expertise, your client base, your income. When you see people pivot out of occupational therapy, not because they hate it or they're fatigued, they're doing something else. Are there some natural off-ramps that people move out and onto?
I would say that the natural off-ramps may B, administration. So not client care anymore, right? Not direct interaction with patients, but running clinics, moving into those types of roles. I would say teaching is another very common one. I would say working for, like I said before, companies that develop rehab equipment, and then administration in any healthcare setting, right? So running a facility, running a hospital, those types of things, running rehab centers, those are all very common. I would also say that I know plenty of people that walked out of graduate school with a bachelor's degree that are now going back for their doctorate for reasons of needing, wanting to do research, wanting to teach, wanting to speak at our national convention and present their research. So if you have a desire for those types of things, there's plenty of avenues for that. A lot of times when people specialize in an area, they'll conduct research in that area, they'll present at the national convention, and then they'll be in the journal. They'll be in our American Journal of Occupational Therapy. It's a big deal to get published in one of those. And then working with other professionals, healthcare professionals, to collaborate and expand our field. The other one that I didn't touch on is becoming a lobbyist in DC for various types of getting insurance to cover various types of diagnoses. So an example is autism. We have people that work for us on the ground in various political settings to help get or help try to get insurance companies to cover various diagnoses.
Jessica, I'm mindful of our time, but I've got three or four more questions. The mission of this podcast is to neither dissuade or persuade someone from entering this career. It's to give people really great access to someone like you that knows all the ins and the outs and maybe even where the profession is going. As you prognosticate, and my sense is you're going to be in this role for the duration of your career or some version of that because of your business and your passion about it. What do you see on the horizon? Is there anything that looks especially promising that might magnetize people into the profession? And then conversely, is there something beyond insurance, but maybe insurance, that would say, gosh, give this thought before you enter. Give us what the future looks like from your own, obviously, point of view.
Yeah, I would say I'll start with that negative because it keeps coming up. And that's really my answer is it's actually my answer to both of those. I would say one, that is always a barrier and it will always be a barrier. And institutions needing to bring in a certain amount of financial income reimbursement and prioritizing that over patient care is going to be a theme. And I don't think it's going anywhere, unfortunately. So that's what is a challenge. I will say in the same vein, there have been advances with what insurance companies will cover and the amount that gets reimbursed. So it's both sides of the coin there. So insurance companies have come a long way in terms of what they will cover and recognizing the care and work that OTs do. But in the same vein, it's always going to be there as a barrier. What I will say, not talking about insurance companies, I am always impressed with new interventions that are coming out with new OTs, younger OTs that are really spending time in certain areas of research, proving or disproving certain interventions. And that is always exciting to see. And the fact that it's harder to get in OT school because so many people want to go to OT school, that's a good thing, right? That means that we are getting the word out there, what we do, that how important OT is to anybody in healthcare or who goes through the system because they need some sort of rehab.
Mm. Let's talk about emerging technologies to the extent that's something you have knowledge or passion around. Most of our listeners know I host a couple of other podcasts. And recently, no relation to you, I don't think, I interviewed Sal Khan, who founded the Khan Academy. And we talked about what the future of AI looks like in terms of he sees a day not so far out where you'll have AI that is monitoring meetings. And it's looking at people's body language. It's helping you follow up on agenda items. It's writing emails for you that help you follow up on tasks that were assigned to you, which is both inspiring and creepy. But as you look at your industry, do you see any emerging technologies that are going to help the practitioner and the patient make more, better, faster progress?
And I'm not super knowledgeable about this. One, because of what you just said, it scares me. Bottom line, it scares me. Do I think it will replace patient care and personal interaction? 100%. I think that's across the board going to happen with every single career. I can definitely see hospitals bringing that in as opposed to having an actual person come in and walking you through your exercises, that may be a computer one day. My only personal experience with it, because I'm like, I can't fight this for much longer, is that I got on ChatGPT with a friend the other day because he said, this is crazy. And I put in just a couple different characteristics of a child that has the diagnosis of autism. And I wanted to see if it would spit back a SOAP note. Those are the general, that's the format of our documentation. And it was very scary. It was a beautiful SOAP note, one that was way better than anything that I would write. And it just had all the details there. So the positive aspect is if this can help our field with documentation and reducing the amount of time that therapists have to do that so that they can increase their time with patients.
Jessica, you used an industry term that I don't think I understand or many don't. A SOAP note? What is it and tell me what that is. Say it slowly.
So a SOAP note is the general format for any, in any medical profession, that is your daily progress note. And it's subjective, objective, assessment, and plan. And anytime we have any patient interaction, a SOAP note gets written.
Jessica, let's end with a couple of final thoughts. As you think about the future of the career, as you think about the progress you've made, the struggles, the frustrations, what advice would you give to someone who is entering this career? I'm guessing people aren't pivoting into OT in their 50s. I'm guessing most people are being trained coming out of college. What, give people a warning shot. Here's what they should be prepared for and expecting.
Okay. I love my job. And what interests me is I thought at my age, I'm 46, I thought that I would be burnt out, or I thought that I would have wanted to move on by now. And that is not true. I love my job. And I encourage people that are looking at this field or about to enter that journey of graduate school that you listen to yourself as the type of setting that you want to go into, because that is very personal. And you have to have certain, like we talked about, characteristics for each of the different types of settings. Pay attention to that. There are so many wonderful different areas of OT that you can get into. You don't have to like kids, because you can also work with adults. So many different areas to look at. I love that about my job. And I would say that, again, really looking at all the new stuff that's coming out in terms of interventions. It's really exciting and really changing the way our field is with more and more research-based studies. But I do love being an OT.
And I'm guessing very mission-driven. Clearly by today's interview, you have great passion around helping people. Is there a reason you chose the adolescent aspect of OT versus some other tranche? Do you just love kids?
I love kids. I always knew, and I actually like them younger. I like the little ones. I like the really little ones. Adolescents are a challenge, but I would say that always knew that I wanted to work with kids. I was always a camp counselor growing up. That was just my thing. And I think to go into pediatric OT, you know that early on, and you know whether I can deal with kids or I can't deal with kids. I just knew I loved kids, and I still do.
Jessica Kahn, owner of Blue Sky Therapeutics. I so appreciate your vulnerability and practicality today. There's not anyone who won't listen to this interview that won't either be galvanized to head toward it or decide to somehow change the insurance process to make it more appealing to practitioners.
I really hope so.
Like yourself. Maybe you'll become a lobbyist someday. I can see you. I can see you in Congress. No, forget lobby. I can just see you being a legislator. Ever appealed to you?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
Jessica, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to today's Career on Course podcast. I hope you are on fire. I hope you are inspired, focused, and ready for what is next for you. Perhaps you've had some clarity on a job you need to quit. Maybe you're enlightened about a career you never even knew existed, or you have key questions answered to make you focused on your next career journey. If you found the content of this podcast helpful, I'd suggest a next great step is to read the book that I've written called Career on Course, 10 Strategies to Take Your Career from Accidental to Intentional. It's available in hardcover, print, audio, and digital anywhere books are sold. We'd love to have you dig back into more episodes and refer any family, friends, or colleagues in case they want to get their career back on course.